It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the midterm elections ran smoothly this year for the most part. A political scientist says that's good news, but we need to invest more in state and local election administration to make voting a better process in the future. First, Republicans fared worse than expected in this year's midterms, with predictions of a red wave that didn't pan out. There are lots of different explanations for why that is. Many political watchers, including some Republicans, point to the poor performance of candidates who denied the results of the 2020 election and were backed by former President Donald Trump. Our next guest says the GOP needs to reject conspiracies and falsehoods and wants to see the party he was part of for 6 years in Congress make a commitment to principles and the Constitution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What messages, if any, do you see in this year's midterm election results? Did you feel in some ways like democracy was on the ballot? If you are a Republican yourself or generally lean Republican, what do you want to see next from the party with its control of the House in future elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Reed Ribbles, a former Republican U.S. representative from Sherwood who represented Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, that includes Green Bay. He retired from that office in 2017. Representative Ribble, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, it's good to be with you.
A lot of people out there with thoughts on why the red wave didn't quite pan out around the country. What was on your mind in the days following the election?
Well, I think the election actually panned out about the way that I saw it. I had tweeted a couple of weeks before the election, and I didn't see a red wave actually forming, in part because I think that a lot of the Trump candidates, endorsed candidates in the primary, were great for the Republican base, but horrible for general elections. And I think that ended up being the case. And we particularly saw that in the state of Pennsylvania, where you had a governor, a Republican governor candidate who just tanked both in the polls and in the election. And the Democrat governor candidate pulled the Democrat Senate candidate through the process.
What does that mean for the future of the Republican Party? What do you want to see the party do in response to those outcomes?
Well, I think they have to really, they have to be honest with themselves and have to do an audit to figure out why they're losing suburban voters, in particular suburban women, and also younger voters. Gen Z, for example, went heavily toward the Democrats. And Republicans have to ask themselves, are we actually campaigning on ideas that matter, or do we need to change direction? And I think the answer is populism is not popular, and they need to change directions. I mean, that's only going to happen if they're honest with themselves.
If I'm a Republican running for office with the possibility of a primary, that might be a tough message for me. I might do better in a general election if I do what you're saying. I might not win a primary if I do what you're saying and offend a significant part of the party base. What would you tell a candidate who came to you for advice if they're having those feelings?
I think that you can be honest without being hateful. And so the idea that you reject everything that Republicans have done, or you get on radio or in your advertising and public speeches demonizing President Trump, I don't think that that's necessarily the right approach. I think we can look at what Governor Youngkin did in Virginia as a model, where he just kind of ignored Trump. He never made it part of the discussion in his campaigns. He didn't invite the president to come and campaign with him. And as a result of that, he won the election based on ideas and policy rather than personality. And I think that was smart. And that's how I would advise any candidate running tomorrow.
On issues, what do you want to see from the Republican Party?
You know, I think they have to actually govern in the way that they campaigned. And what I mean by that is they have to stop talking about investigations and Hunter Biden, for God's sake. They just have to get rid of all that nonsense. And they have to deal with what people said that matters to them. They don't like paying, you know, $3 to $4 a gallon for gasoline. They don't like the fact that their grocery bill has gone up 25%. I think this issue of inflation really matters to people, because everything costs more and it's stretching voters thin. And I think they should focus on issues of economics. And I also think that the issue of crime is important, and they need to try to figure out what they can do from a policy standpoint to begin to reduce crime in our major metropolitan areas. And if they would do that, they would be able to pull some of those suburban women back into the fold.
We've seen tweets from Republican House leadership and press conferences and announcements saying Hunter Biden investigations are on the way. What are you watching for there? What are your reactions when you see that?
I think that's all going to tank in the public. The fact of the matter is most Americans are not interested in what the president's children do. And the problem I have with this whole thing, Rob, is that if Republicans all lean into this Hunter Biden thing, what's going to happen as soon as Democrats take over? They're going to go after Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner and Don Jr. and Eric Jr. And you're never going to end. And the fact of the matter is we ought to judge presidents based on what presidents do and the policies that they bring to the forefront and whether they're taking care of roads and bridges and the things that really matter to the voter. And I will tell you that Hunter Biden doesn't resonate with a lot of Republican voters. That's why they didn't campaign on it. They campaigned on crime and inflation, but the minute they won, the first thing they talked about was Hunter Biden. It's ridiculous, and it's going to be damaging to them.
Talking to Reid Ribble, former Republican congressman from Wisconsin, looking at the future of the Republican Party. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. I wonder if you share my excitement. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in 2024. We now have more elected Republicans in Congress than we've had in a long time. And in a generation, up here in northern Wisconsin, we got three elected Republican representatives in the Assembly and the Senate. The Republican Party was started in Ripon, Wisconsin, 1854. Aren't we in a position to renew and refresh our political agenda here?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And if leadership in the state of Wisconsin, in both the Senate and the Assembly, would focus on the things that matter to Wisconsin voters, they would be in a good position. And I was encouraged by the fact that Robin Voss met with Governor Evers recently. I think that that's a step forward. The fact of the matter is Wisconsin has done what Wisconsin does. They're a bit schizophrenic in how they vote, right? They put a Democrat governor in charge, but then they continue to put Republicans in charge of the legislative body. And so the citizens are saying, we want you to work together for the good of the citizens of Wisconsin. And I hope they do that by watching what they're doing with taxation, fixing the roads and bridges in the state, getting broadband available in rural Wisconsin. Those would be things that would really help them along the way and also help Wisconsin citizens.
Jeff, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. You mentioned that brief, I think, Voss-Evers meeting. Republicans and Democrats in Wisconsin state government not playing well together much lately. Same goes for Congress. Do you see areas where you think cooperation is possible and maybe even likely?
I think at the state level, sure. And the state level's always had a bit more comity in it than the federal level has. And so I think there are some opportunities. I just mentioned a couple with infrastructure and broadband, also crime. There's not a lot that Governor Evers can do about or the Assembly can do about inflation. At the federal level, certainly if they would expand leases and the production of energy in the U.S., I think that that would help pull some gasoline prices down and home heating and natural gas prices down. All those things would help. But at the federal level, I just don't see it. I think that it's going to be chaos for another 2 years with hardly anything getting done. With one exception, Rob, I think it's possible that they could get something done on immigration reform because the crisis at the border is real. And the fact that employers cannot find enough workers is real. And there's an opportunity for bipartisan reform to happen there.
We're talking to Reid Ribble, former Republican member of Congress who represented Wisconsin's 8th district until 2017. With us today to reflect on this year's midterm election results, what they mean for the future of the Republican Party here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a midterm election lesson that you think Republicans should follow, whether you are a Republican or not? What questions do you have for former Representative Ribble about the current state of the party and American and Wisconsin politics? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the future of the Republican Party. After Republicans did not as well as expected in this year's midterm elections, former Republican U.S. Representative Reid Ribble stays with us, and you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. If you are a Republican in particular, what are you hoping to see or hear from your party? 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls. Rebecca is with us in Mineral Point. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Rebecca?
Well, for Mr. Ribble, I am finding it a very good conversation. I'm an independent voter, and I'm enjoying listening to his comments. But my question is, he mentioned that Wisconsin elected a Democratic governor, and yet our state legislature is overly Republican, and that he says that that means we want them to work together. But my question is, when our state is gerrymandered, that it's near impossible in some areas to elect a Democrat. How can that be? How is he reading that? I'm confused. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Rebecca, thanks for calling. Gerrymandered, I think, is the word that was cut off by your phone line
right
there.
Yeah, no, thanks, Rebecca. I mean, you're right in one regard that the districts are gerrymandered, but in reality, if you look at the overall county map of the state of Wisconsin, almost all the rural areas are Republican and red, and the more urban, suburban, exurban areas are Democratic. It's very difficult to draw maps in a state like Wisconsin, where the population is so densely compacted in Milwaukee and Madison, Green Bay, cities like that, and draw a district that will pull those blue voters, because they're compacted, they're too densely populated, and people have a tendency to move to where they have affinity with other people. So Republicans have a tendency to move to rural areas, and Democrats have a tendency to move to urban areas. And it would be almost impossible to draw a map in the state of Wisconsin that would not have the same divide. You could maybe pull some blue areas down and some red areas down and make them more blue, but you wouldn't be able to draw a map that I think would change much of the nature of the state assembly, for sure. Maybe more impact on the state Senate. But just by virtue of where people live in Wisconsin, it'd be very difficult to draw a map that didn't result in a Republican assembly.
Thanks for that call. When I've talked to the numbers people on that, they agree there is a natural gerrymander, as you're talking about, Representative Ribble. But the way the lines were drawn magnify that some and make it almost as easy for Republicans to get a supermajority in the assembly as Democrats to get a narrow majority in the assembly. There's a little of both going on, right?
I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, political parties are going to do that. And if you lived in Illinois, like I did for a few years, you would see the inverse of that, where the Democrats are basically drawing districts to eliminate Republican seats entirely. Adam Kinzinger, for example, his seat was eliminated, and he was one of the more pragmatic members of the Illinois delegation. And so you would think they would have gerrymandered out one of the more hard right guys in Southern Illinois, but they couldn't do it because of the way the voters that live and kind of separate themselves. But I don't disagree with you, Rob. It's been gerrymandered, and I would prefer that voters pick their candidates or their elected officials rather than the inverse.
Thanks again for that call. Bill joins us now in Waupaca. Bill, hi.
Hello, Representative Ribble. I was one of your constituents when you were in Congress, and I think you earn the respect of both Democrats and Republicans when you were in Congress. So my question is, I think you could win if you entered the governor's race. What are your thoughts on that?
Bill, I appreciate that. That's a really kind thing to say. But when I left Congress, I told people that my primary purpose in leaving was to spend more time with my grandchildren, who I've got a 1-year-old all the way to a 19-year-old that's studying at the University of Alabama. And I wanted to be closer to them, and they live in Tennessee, and I spend the bulk of my time down in Tennessee, so I can be closer to them. And so I think my time has come and gone for being an elected official, but I can have some opportunity to weigh in on things and try to balance things out by having conversations like I'm having with Rob and with you today.
Bill, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, Bill used a phrase there, Representative Ribble, you know, respected by Democrats and Republicans, and he said it like it was a good thing. I think there's a lot of people in either party who would take that as an insult. If you're respected by the other party, you must be doing something wrong.
Well, exactly. And I heard that all the time. I had about, I would often say I've got 10% of my voters screaming at me in the right ear and 10% of my voters screaming at me in my left ear. And the 80%, those people who actually really liked what I was doing, they just went about their business. They went to work. They watched their kids play soccer and go to concerts, and they lived their lives. And they told me, you know, Congressman, I just want you to deal with those issues, and you make the best judgment you can. And by being more pragmatic, I think the voters in the broad swipe, both across party lines, appreciated the work that I did.
Talking to former congressional representative from Wisconsin, Reed Ribble, about the future of the Republican Party and American politics, Wisconsin politics more generally. Back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Door County. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, hi. Great topic. I appreciate what he's saying about crossing the aisle and getting back to business to do what the people want. But I am a little concerned about some of the rhetoric, like the price of gas. I just paid $3 for a tank for a gallon of gas. So, and gas isn't controlled by the president that's sitting. And the thing about crime is up in the inner city. It's not up in the suburbs. And these talking points are being driven by our representatives.
Jeff, thanks for the call. I think we lost Jeff at the end of that sentence. Yeah. There, Representative Ribble, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I appreciate what he's saying. And the idea that gas isn't controlled by the president is partially accurate, but it's only partially so. All gasoline is priced based on global supply of oil. And so obviously if the Saudis if Russia reduces the supply, it's going to shove the price up. But that doesn't mean that the country with the most oil, which is us, couldn't increase productivity and expand our production, expand refineries. But it takes years and years and years just to get a permit to build a refinery in the United States today. And so there are policy things that we could do. And I don't think he's wrong regarding crime in that if you lived in rural Wisconsin, you're probably not too concerned about it. But if we were having a caller call us from the inner city of Milwaukee, they would be very concerned about it. And so it just depends on where you live and the ideas that impact you. And so I partially agree with Jeff, but I partially disagree.
Thanks again for that call. Something that I think about a lot is in Congress in particular, I think it seems like the incentive structure is to not cooperate with the other party, to not look for that compromise, the common ground, appeal to the base, not move toward moderation. Do you see that? Do you see that as a problem? If so, what could be done about it?
Yeah, it's absolutely a problem. However, I do think that depending on how you talk to people, how you conduct yourself, What most people want is they want government to work. I did hear from Republican constituents that I was playing too nicely with the Democrats. But at the end of the day, when you really had a chance to sit down and talk with them and kind of dig a little bit deeper, what they wanted was they did want government to actually work. They just didn't appreciate the policy reforms or the compromises that might have to happen to get to a bipartisan agreement. And I heard often, don't compromise your principles. And my response to that is, I'll guarantee you that I will never compromise a principle, but you must allow me to seek a principled compromise. And when you would talk with people in the right manner and you wouldn't demonize someone for how they felt about something, you were able to find that you were able to find common ground with even the hard right or hard left.
Now, our next conversation on the show today is going to be about how the midterm elections were managed, and possible changes in the future. You've written about claims of election wrongdoing over the last couple of elections. Can you share some of your thoughts as you've watched, especially the Republican Party on these issues?
Yeah, we don't really have an election integrity problem in the country. Never have had. There's always been instances of fraud, and there's been some fraud that's taken place. I think you can always find it, but it's really, really in the fringes, and it's a very small number. And so, first of all, we have to stop telling people that we've got all this election integrity problem, because we don't. And that's just the harsh reality of it. And what we have to realize is that in all those thousands of precincts across the state of Wisconsin, they're typically manned and votes are typically counted by volunteers, mostly senior citizens, Democrats and Republicans alike, who just want to do a public service. This our elections are governed by our neighbors. And I would just encourage people to trust your neighbor. If you don't trust government officials, at least trust them. And we can build some confidence back in our elections, because our elections are fair and they're being managed in a positive way. That doesn't mean we can't do better, but they're not horrible.
We've seen in Wisconsin, we had a Republican candidate for governor who ran kind of against the election system, finished a very distant third place. Former President Trump tried to support a primary challenge to Robin Voss because Voss wouldn't support Trump's election claims. Voss will still be the speaker. Are you encouraged by some of the signs you've seen here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, because I think Wisconsinites are pretty pragmatic folks. When you kind of get underneath all the layers of partisanship, they're a pragmatic group. And so I am encouraged by that.
Representative Ribble, thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, great to be with you, Rob. Thank you.
That's Reid Ribble, former Republican U.S. representative who represented Wisconsin's 8th House District. He was with us today to reflect on this year's midterm elections, what the results could mean for the future direction of the Republican Party. Coming up after the news, we'll turn from the politics to the process of the midterm elections, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago. Our next guest says things went smoothly, but there's a lot we can do to improve voting in the United States, especially when it comes to supporting local election offices and polling stations. If you worked on the election this midterm year, or if you've done it many years, you did it in the past, love to hear your story. You can get us started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or hang on and call in after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime at WPR.org or with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Listen live to either of our networks, and you can pull up archived content as well. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what would it be like to travel over 6,000 miles for a year on a boat with just one other person? We'll talk to a husband and wife team from Manitowoc who just completed America's Great Loop. Now, the midterm elections ended without widespread claims of fraud and without disruptions at voting locations. In other words, the election was pretty normal. While the midterms came and went without many issues, our next guest says there's still work to be done on state and local election administration, especially before the presidential election in a couple years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you voted in person, did you experience longer lines than anticipated? Was it what you expected? If you voted by mail, did that go smoothly? And if you worked on the election, maybe at a polling station on election day, love to hear your experience, maybe your thoughts on what could work better, even if it's just have more people working at the polling place. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Stewart III is the Kenan Sahin Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's also director of the MIT Election Lab. He co-wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal with Nathaniel Persley called "The Midterms Revealed the Real Challenges Facing Our Elections." Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
In your op-ed, you describe the election as being, as I just said, fairly normal. What do you mean by that?
Well, by normal, we mean that a lot of people showed up to vote. The results were known fairly quickly in most places. There were minimal number of disruptions reported in the news, and almost all of the candidates behaved themselves, including the ones who lost.
Yeah, a lot of what we define as normal, I guess, is based on the things that didn't happen. No widespread claims of fraud. There were fears of disruptions, maybe at polling stations for one reason or another. Were we just too worried, or did we do something right that prevented those things from happening?
It's a bit of both. I mean, I would emphasize the latter, which is that we, and by which I mean election officials mostly at the local level and the workers in the polling places, did what they normally do, which is pay attention to the details and, you know, get this huge logistical operation up and running and successfully completed. I do think in retrospect that many people in the public and some who were kind of prominent figures sometimes went a little too hair on fire worrying about this election. And I think we learned a lot from this midterm election about how to assess the worst case scenarios that may show up on election day.
And before we go into some of those suggestions for the future, there was some reporting that election officials at state and local levels were more proactive than, say, in 2020 at countering misinformation or disinformation about how things were going. Did you see that in action?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of places, especially the most technologically savvy or social media savvy, were very aggressive in getting the message out to find the facts, reach out to trusted election officials for information. Many of them were holding what I call petting zoos for election equipment to really show what the equipment is like, and had very well-designed websites with a load of information, press appearance, and those sorts of things. And so I think particularly in larger jurisdictions and jurisdictions that might have a more savvy kind of population access to more sophisticated media outreach, we saw an awful lot of that, and I'm sure that made a big difference.
Now, that said, did you see hiccups of various sorts that, you know, we might have been able to skate by in a midterm but might be a bigger problem in a higher turnout election like a presidential election year?
Well, I think, you know, the things that we saw were small hiccups, as you call them, but that's normal for a midterm. You know, turnout in a midterm is about 60% of what it is in a presidential election. The big problems that emerge on election day, especially in a presidential year, have to do with capacity and being up against the limits or beyond the limits of the capacity of the system. So, you know, we saw little things this time, which were hiccups, but could be bigger problems in the future. I'll list a couple of them. One was reports of long lines in some places. Another was this problem of recruiting enough of the election workers in many places. That may have led to long lines, but it certainly led to mistakes being made on election day with recording what needs to be recorded. There was also, you know, there were controversies. In fact, Wisconsin was one of the places where there was controversies around, say, drop boxes and the details around how mail ballots would be handled, whether they could be pre-processed, whether they could be processed without a date on them, even if they had arrived before election day, things like that, which would be small in number in a midterm because of the nature of the electorate. But in a presidential election where the stakes are much higher, particularly with the presidential office, you can take one state or one locality with a drop box controversy, and you could blow that up into an entire battleground state or a couple of battleground states. And, you know, that would be, maybe a repeat of 2020.
Talking to Charles Stewart, a political scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, director there of the MIT Election Lab, looking at lessons from the midterm election, ways we can improve voting and elections in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest, your experiences as a voter or someone working maybe at a polling station or at a clerk's office. Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Andy is with us in Appleton. Andy, hi.
Hey, Rob and Charles. Pleasantries. I have, I'm a Marine Corps veteran, so I feel like I got a stake in being an American and vote every chance I get. I love the mail-in ballots or drop boxes and get a chance to research the candidates as well as referendums before I cast a vote and feel like it's thoughtful. But my question, my reason for calling in was, I think we had about roughly 2.7 million people voted in this midterms. I know there's a lot of excitement about voting. We had 3.5 roughly million people in Wisconsin who are registered voters. But Wisconsin estimates we have 4.5 roughly million people eligible to vote. So that's a million gap somewhere in there. And how do we encourage people to be registered voters easier?
Andy, thanks a lot for the call. There's a lot there, Charles, when it comes to voter turnout. Are there ways in the election system to make it, I don't know, less frictiony, make it easier for people who want, as Andy does, to make that move from non-voter to voter?
Absolutely. And we need more people like Andy who vote in a re-election. I mean, I think that's great. Yeah, you know, this is one of the great conundrums in the United States. I mean, I think that, you know, in Wisconsin, Wisconsin has one of the highest turnout rates in the United States. And Wisconsin actually is almost as frictionless as possible in voting. You have election day registration. You have a tradition of high turnout. There are some small things that could be done in Wisconsin, but you know, the statistics that were cited, I think, suggest just how really hard nationwide it would be to get everybody to vote, short of making voting compulsory. As a kind of one shot item, the one item that I usually emphasize that's not talked about a lot is emphasizing the registration of young people. Again, Wisconsin is already, you know, it's very, very easy in Wisconsin to register and to change your registration. But that's not the case nationwide. And in the United States, our biggest turnout and registration gap is with people who are 30 years of age and younger. The main problem there is that that's a highly mobile population, and they're hard to follow by the campaigns. They just kind of fall off the radar and every time they move. And so if we could do things to instill the habit of voting among young people, that can include pre-registration of 16 and 17 year olds, which is allowed in many, many states, taking the advice of Wisconsin, and having election day registration so that people who've been highly mobile can show up and vote, even if they've moved since the last election and can prove that they are who they are. I mean, that's something that I would really emphasize, is getting young people on the polls, getting young people signed up. That helps to start the habit, and then it gets them on the list of the candidates, and then the candidates are the ones who actually work hard to get those people who are registered to the polls.
Andy, thanks for that call. Charles, I want to start to get into some of your recommendations for the future now. The heart of this Wall Street Journal piece I mentioned, one, you'd like to see Congress put up some money and resources to help with things like, you know, worker registration and smoothing things out at the polls. What kind of things could the federal government do?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, providing funding could really be the most important thing the federal government can do. I think it's very fraught. If I could step back just for about 10 seconds to note that Congress did have this bill, H.R. 1, was making its way through Congress. It was a very prescriptive bill. It was very divisive. And I kind of thought from the beginning it would never get through Congress because of the divisiveness. And even if Manchin and Sinema had come along earlier, something else would have happened. And so I think that being very prescriptive at the federal level is something that's not to be advised. But paying for elections could be advised. And I think that there's a good formula that we could use to put federal payments for election administration on a solid footing. And that would be a great thing, an appropriate way, I think, for the federal government to be more involved in helping to support elections.
We're talking to Charles Stewart III, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at MIT, Director there of the MIT Election Lab, talking about the election system in the U.S., how it functioned during the midterms, some changes that could help them go more smoothly in the future. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. As a voter, how did things go for you? Are there things you think could be done to make it better, to make you more confident in your vote? If you work on elections, or maybe you did it for the first time this midterms, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Charles Stewart III, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at MIT, talking about the voting system in the U.S., how it did during the midterm election, possible improvements for the future. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Hey, Rob. As usual, I love what you're doing there on this show.
Thanks.
You know, when I was a resident of Virginia, I got my driver's license at 16. I was automatically pre-registered to vote. And then at 18, I got a card in the mail that said, okay, you're a registered voter. Here's your polling location based on your address. You know, polls are open from this time to this time on election day. Next election is whenever, you know. And then it said, you know, if your address changed between, you know, now and when you get this, let us know. But otherwise, that was it. You were in. So, you know, and you had your driver's license. I think they did it because most people, when they're 16, they don't move between 16 and 18, you know. So it was a pretty secure system.
Martha, thanks a lot for sharing that story. That's backing up what you were talking about earlier, Charles, a way to get younger people ready to rock on voting day.
Absolutely.
Martha, thanks a lot for that call. Do we see a trend toward more states doing that? We don't in Wisconsin, for example.
Right. There was a movement for a while for more states doing pre-registration. There's been a bit of a backlash in some Republican-controlled states to undo pre-registration. It's moving very slowly. I think the issue is that many Republicans are noting that young people are overwhelmingly supporting Democratic candidates these days, which makes it a hard sell, particularly in a state that has a so-called Republican trifecta.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Charles, I want to ask about another part of the Wall Street Journal piece. You say, you know, if it's a question of speed or accuracy when in counting votes, everybody agrees accuracy is more important, but speed matters too. Could you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're blessed in the United States in that we're living through a period of great controversy over our elections. We've not had the degree of controversy that we see in many other countries around the world. And one of the things that election observers have established that really a best practice is to get the election results out to the public as quickly as possible and as transparently as possible. So we've seen in this country that as it takes longer to count votes, it gives an opening to people who would sow discord and misinformation to suggest that something nefarious is going on, that there are people in the back room with printing presses and printing out ballots with their favorite candidate on it. So there is a real value to speeding up the count so long as it is, you know, done quickly. Most of the country actually is able to get, you know, 90-95% of their votes counted, certainly by the Wednesday morning following Election Day. And even many states that don't allow the pre-processing of mail ballots make really good progress on Election Day. States make choices, policy choices, local governments make policy and resource allocation choices that largely determine how quickly the election returns are reported to the public. And so, I mean, I think we see examples, even in this election, which was pretty normal, of election deniers wanting to focus on the long count in some of the states, especially out west, to suggest that there's something nefarious going on. And there's really only one way to nip that one in the bud, and that's to be serious about the speed of counting and not just to dismiss the issue by just saying, well, we're going to be accurate at the expense of being fast. You can have both to a certain degree.
Let's go back to our callers. Randy is with us in La Crosse. Randy, hello.
Well, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm 70, so I've been voting for a long time, and almost every election I voted for the lesser of two evils. So if we could solve that dilemma, we might encourage more people to want to come out and vote. Also, if we had direct referendum, I think every election there should be two or three direct referendums on the ballot so that the people could actually start to be governed by their own desires.
Randy, thanks for the call. Charles, of course, we in Wisconsin can read headlines about other states and their ballot referenda, their binding ones. Here in Wisconsin, we have non-binding advisory ones at the county or local level. Constitutional amendments have to get passed twice by the legislature, and then they go to voters. But that's it. We don't have that. Do you have thoughts on pros or cons of states moving toward binding statewide referenda that at least Randy would like to see more of?
Right. Well, you know, that's very interesting. And I have to say, it is a bit of a surprise given the progressive history of Wisconsin that y'all don't have what's known as the initiative, citizen initiative for legislating. Well, you know, in terms of turnout, there does appear to be a pull to having initiatives on the ballot. I've recently quipped that if you want a high turnout election, make sure you put a recreational marijuana question on the ballot, because you'll get another 5% of the vote to turn out just because of a pot referendum. And you also, you know, oftentimes states will put these initiatives on low turnout elections, like the spring primaries, during the midterm elections, and they do actually get more people to the polls, and it does make those elections more representative of what the electorate is than in those otherwise small or low turnout elections.
Thanks for calling in, Randy. Charles, we got through this midterm election, as you said earlier, with a pretty normal election. Do you have hopes that some of the changes you're looking for would find support in Congress, bipartisan support in Congress, or at the state level to get some of these changes and better support for polling stations and such in place for the 2024 presidential elections?
Yes, a couple of things really quickly. First of all, they're in the current appropriations bill moving through Congress in the lame duck. I understand that there's several hundred million dollars allocated to election administration. Probably for security, I could be wrong about that, but there is seriousness in Congress about the federal government paying its fair share, and that's a good down payment. So I'm hoping that stays in the bill. That would be wonderful for Congress to do. At the state level, I think in general, one of the things I've noticed in the past year as I've gone around the country talking to state legislatures and election officials all over the place, including in many of these states, red and purple states, where there's really been a lot of tension, that there is a hunger, actually, when you talk to legislators privately about election administration, there is a hunger to get back to more evidence-based legislating in the election administration realm. And so I am hoping, now that the temperature has been turned down a little bit, that when the state legislatures convene in January, there will be greater interest in, you know, dealing with issues of the speed of counting, mail ballots, recruiting election officials or election workers, threats against election workers, and those sorts of things. I think there is an opening that we have over the next several months to take advantage of this kind of era of good feeling in election administration.
Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Charles Stewart III, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Director of the MIT Election Lab. He joined us to talk about a piece he co-wrote for the Wall Street Journal. It's called "The Midterms Revealed the Real Challenges Facing Our Elections." Still time for you to share your thoughts. If there's an election change you'd like to see here in Wisconsin, email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow morning, Thanksgiving Day at 11, get last-minute cooking help for your Thanksgiving meal. It's this year's edition of Turkey Confidential. I'm keeping it pretty simple. Going to grill, not turkey, chicken on the grill. That's my plan. So I don't think I'm going to need any of their help. Maybe you do. That's tomorrow morning at 11 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday, I shared the 10 most common dog names for 2022, but maybe you're thinking, Rob, I have to name a dog and I want something different from everybody else. I got you, fam, because last night I stumbled across a great new source of dog names. From the website Metafilter, I saw an article about dogs in medieval Europe. It included a list created by Edward, 2nd Duke of York, in the early part of the 1400s. The list is titled The Names of All Manner of Hounds. There are over 1,000 names on the list. Duke Edward liked his dogs, and he had some time on his hands. Here are some samples. You have to picture the old-fashioned spellings. Honeyball, Conqueror, Helpless or Harmless, Brian with a Y, Filth or Filthy, I'm not sure what to do with that E on the end, Bracelet, Rude Enough, Rage, Pretty Man and Pretty Boy, Mr. Man, Nosewise, Tully Mully, Brainless, and best of all, the name Best of All. Medieval dog news you can use. This is Central Time.